Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network.
This is James Altucher with the James Altucher Show, and I have a very special guest today, although I feel like I always have a very special guest. And my co-host today, Aaron Brabham. Aaron, all of my guests are special, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. You know, this is something that I find myself kind of going on repeat mode for the Stansberry Radio Show that I co-host with Porter Stansberry. But the truth is, we do reach out to get the best talent that we can. And but James, you have exceeded expectations yet again. The guy that you're bringing on today, I watched his documentary probably 6 months ago. I'm a big Netflix guy. I love documentaries, especially anything that's about growth or self-help or any of that type of junk. And I say junk as in just kidding, because I love that stuff. And he has a great documentary out there. So why don't you introduce him?
Yeah, it's Tom Shadyac. You might have heard of his name, but you've definitely heard of some of his movies, if not all of them. So obviously he did Ace Ventura. He did Liar Liar, Patch Adams, Bruce Almighty, Evan Almighty. But we're here today. We're going to talk to him about his book that's about to go into paperback, Life's Operating Manual, which is also based on his documentary called I Am. And all of this is excellent. So as usual, I highly recommend the book, else I wouldn't have him on the show. And I think that's a common theme. You know, I'm not going to have someone on the show whose works I don't like. And there's a common theme of all the guests we have on the show, which is that they reach some point in their life where they were like, I have to change. And then they, whether it was hitting bottom or getting physically hurt or going broke or something happened to them that caused them to reinvent their lives. And I'll let Tom tell his story, but it's pretty remarkable what happened to him. I mean, he went from the top of the heap movie director, and then you'll see in the interview what happened after that. I mean, he's still a great movie director, but you'll see what changed in his life, what caused him to change, and how he feels about it now. So it's an incredible story. I'm very excited to have him on the show.
Yeah, it's going to be a great interview. You know, James, here's one thing that I always wonder is, and you get tons of feedback about this. And as always, your listeners can email james@stansberryradio.com, ask James a question. So here's what I always wonder myself. Would he have gone on this journey had he not had any money? Had he not had all that success that he had before? Would he have even thought to go on this journey? Because I think that whole rise through the fame gave him a completely different perspective when he got sick. But it's just one of those things I always think about.
No, that's a good question. And it's sort of the elephant in the room, really, because, you know, we all go through this so-called hierarchy of needs. You know, we need shelter, then we need, you know, love and attention. And, you know, then we need some form of achievement. And then after that, we go for self-actualization and kind of asking the question, who am I and why am I here on this earth and can I do good? And, you know, it's great if you could get to that point. And Tom has clearly gone above and beyond that point. We'll hear the story how. But would he have got, the question is, would he have gotten there if he hadn't already, you know, achieved everything he had set out to do when he began his career as a movie director? So I will be asking that. You know, I think the answer with him, you know, we'll see what he says. But, you know, he comes from a family that was heavily involved in charity. His father started a hospital for basically helping children with cancer so that they wouldn't have to pay even a dime for their care. So he comes from a family that was rooted in charity and forced these questions, you know, in the household as he was growing up. And I'm sure that played a big effect on him. But look, let's find out what he says.
Yeah, that sounds great. Well, let's not wait anymore. Let's jump straight into the interview.
This is James Altucher, back with the James Altucher Show, and I'm with guest Tom Shadyac. Tom, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Appreciate you having me on your show.
Oh my gosh, I'm really thankful you're on the show. And I'll just give a tiny intro because I think probably most people know who you are, but just in case they don't, you've directed all of these movies, Ace Ventura, Patch Adams, The Nutty Professor, Liar Liar, Bruce Almighty, Evan Almighty. Altogether, I think it's about $2 billion in box office revenues. So you're a successful director. And then something happened. And I'll start it off, but then, Tom, I want you to kind of get into the story. You basically had a bicycle accident in, I think it was 2007, and things took off from there.
Yeah. Well, I had been changing all along. You know, once the money, so to speak, started rolling in, and the happiness didn't necessarily roll in with it, the contentment, the meaning, I enjoyed being an artist. I enjoyed the freedom that the success in the art world gave me. But I sort of was feeling the emptiness of the declared promise of the American dream as I went along. And I literally went from a 8,000 square foot house to a 17,000 square foot three-home compound in Pasadena. And you've heard the story many times from many others. It didn't fill that void. So the bike accident, I had begun changing my life for many years. You know, the money sort of started rolling in after Liar Liar.
I want to point out that in your book, Life's Operating Manual, you did something I've seen really no other director do in a book. You kind of laid it out exactly how much you made per movie. So I think on Liar Liar, you mentioned you made something like $8 million, or, you know,
Liar Liar was closer to Yeah, Liar Liar was closer to five, I think. And then by the time I was at Patch Adams, it was somewhere around 7 to 10. And then because of Bruce Almighty, we grossed nearly $500 million at the box office, and I was a part owner of that film. It was 30 plus million dollars. So yeah, it's a bit obscene, if you will. And I felt
or
the
not.
Imbalance.
I think no one's judging if you make money or not.
Well, there's a philosophy behind it, though, that I think is a bit toxic. You know, when an artist claims to be worth more, while others, even on the same film set, aren't necessarily able to meet the expenses of their family and their needs. I think there's a toxic philosophy that I think we have to look at, that I certainly felt convicted to look at, and how I wanted to proceed in terms of a voice on this planet. So I do my business life very differently. But to go back to the story that you asked me to begin, the bike accident, because that had been changing, you know, I'd simplified my life. I'd sold my large homes and I'd started giving away more. I'd always shared, you know, I'm from a very generous family. My dad helped found St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital, which treats kids with cancer for free. So I've always been a part of that world, which knows the importance of sharing, but I just had too much, and I began to share more and more, and the bike accident compelled me to talk about those changes that I was making in my life and the contentment levels which had risen along with those changes.
Well, it's because you had this bike accident, and then you had post-concussive syndrome. Like, the symptoms of your concussion continued, and you didn't know when they would end. So what was happening that year when you were experiencing this concussion?
Well, it's a quite torturous condition. There's a reason that people often, sadly, commit suicide when these symptoms don't go away. Having a concussion for a day is painful enough, but post-concussion means that your symptoms linger long after the initial concussion, and the causative concussion. So, I was 5 months into this, and, you know, there's a ringing sound in your head that won't, at least there was in mine, that wouldn't go away. It's just like a computer on overload. You can't take information in. The light is too much. The sound is too much. And you just want to shut down. And so I ended up literally living in a dark room for several of those months. I slept in a closet, a darkened closet. Again, just trying to allow the computer, the brain, to reset. And when those symptoms didn't go away, I didn't think I was going to live. I simply did not think I was going to live. And death became a motivator in my life, and I decided to make that film I Am, and to talk about some of the principles that I had woken up to and some of the changes that I had made in my life and the effect that it had had on my life. And it gave me a context and a springboard to start a conversation about who we are as people and how we're moving forward and what might be broken about the vision that we have for this world and how we educate and do business with each other. And I created this film I Am.
And with I Am, you went around to many of the people who had inspired you during your journey. You interviewed them. You asked them what was wrong with the world. And what kind of general sentiment did you find among these people you interviewed? You interviewed people like Desmond Tutu, all of these spiritual leaders and philosophers.
Yeah, well, it turned from a negative question. The question, what's wrong with the world, is negative in its approach. And that's how I started the film. But the byline ended up to be, we started by asking what's wrong with the world, and we ended up discovering what's right with it. And when you sit in a room with Desmond Tutu and the likes of Howard Zinn, and great scientists that are doing alternative science, like Noam Chomsky, of course, is a linguist. He was a participant in the film as well. Lynn McTaggart is one of those alternative scientists, and other scientists from the Institute of Noetic Science in San Francisco. I got incredibly hopeful. It's hard not to have an optimistic outlook when you look at the research that's been done, the science that is being conducted about who we are, about how we're hardwired. Of course, we're told a story every day on the news that we're pre-violent and wired for aggression and selfishness. And the more I talk to these researchers, people like Dacher Keltner at Berkeley, I was optimistic. I couldn't not be, because so much evidence was surfacing about what Martin Luther King would call the moral arc of the universe bending toward justice. It's bending that way because we're hardwired that way. And so the ball pushes towards justice, which is, of course, an expression of love and compassion. It just pushes that way because that's who we are.
And in your book, Life's Operating Manual, you get into some of the evolutionary aspects of this, of how we switched from being somewhat more peaceful to more violent, and what happened historically to us. But I want to get back for a second to your story of the bike accident and what happened in the aftermath of after the symptoms of the concussion were going away. What did you suddenly do? Like, you made huge changes in your life. Like, what actually triggered that, and what did you do?
Well, again, it's not the bike accident that triggered the huge changes. Those were they had come beforehand, and I continue to make them. I simplified my life because I realized that the complexity it wasn't about the accumulation of the kind of wealth that we value in this society. It was an accumulation of a different kind of wealth that I was after, W-E-L-L-T-H. And so I began to share more of my resources. I gave more money away, started a few nonprofits, helped other nonprofits, began to teach in a local college, which had me engage in this conversation with young people who were able to push my conversation further along, edify me, encourage me. I sold, again, much of my real estate and got myself, you know, just a simpler life. They say there's three keys to the spiritual life: simplicity, simplicity, simplicity. And I started walking more in that path. I moved into a beautiful, it's expensive, but it's still a simple lifestyle, a mobile home park, lived in a 1,000-square-foot double wide, essentially. But again, it's a beautiful mobile home park. It's expense, cost money to live here, but it's out of the paradigm. And you know, when I did this, my friends, you know, and some of my advisors thought I'd lost it, and I personally felt like that I'd found it, you know.
Did anyone kind of drop you from their lives? Because I'll tell you my own experience when I had a similar type of transition. I had both friends and family completely drop me from their lives.
I think there was a lot of whispering about me, I think it still goes on. They didn't necessarily drop me, like, I'll never talk to that guy again. But
I had people say that, actually.
Is that right?
Yes.
They could have been much friends anyway, right?
That could be. That's probably what it turned out to be.
Yeah, so it's probably not a drop, but an add in terms of a quality for you.
Right.
Look, the way I live and the things that I was calling into question can appear to some as a threat to their way of life. You said it earlier, this is not a philosophy that's judgmental. I don't want it to be. I don't judge the path of another who hasn't felt the same things that I've felt or hasn't called into question the things that I've called into question. Everybody has a path, and I respect the path of others, even when it's very different than my own. But look, I am outside the box, very outside the box. And
just going from a 17,000-square-foot, set of homes to a mobile home. Like tonight, are you going back to a mobile home to sleep? Like that's definitely a big transition.
Yeah, but it's not what you think. It's a modest space in terms of size. It's not what, you know, many people that are quote unquote successful economically go home to. But I go home to everything I need. I really don't push a gospel of austerity. I push a gospel of how much do you need to lead a life that is meaningful, purposeful, joyful. You know, I don't want people to walk around in a self-flagellatory state, you know, in that state of, quote, sacrifice. You find that when you simplify and you just take what you need and you just give yourself what you need, you find there's space for so many other things. And so it's not a life where you would walk into and say, wow, I've had Oprah's camera crew over here. And they went, this is nice. It is nice. Again, it's not a 40,000-square-foot house, but it's a 1,000-square-foot or 1,500 square feet. And it's fine. It's plenty, you know?
So in your book, Life's Operating Manual, you have a quote, which I really like. We don't become happy by focusing on happiness, by pursuing it. We focus instead on what is true, what is good, what is right, and happiness follows. And you basically mentioned that you didn't make this transition in order to, specifically with the goal in mind, to become happy. But what happened is that you made this transition and you started to feel these immense feelings of joy and comfort and happiness and so on. I mean, what what would you suggest to somebody? I mean, happiness is sort of a weird word to define, just like success is. Like, you can either define it from this internal part of yourself or with the external definitions we are all taught. Like, when you say happiness, what do you mean?
I prefer the word contentment, because contentment is rooted in the word content, and content's what's on the inside. Happiness can be traced to the word happenstance, which is the occurrences on the outside. It's all a matter of how you define either word. And I think the idea of happiness is rooted in what we would call well-being. And well-being can mean physically. How is my physical health? Now, how's my mental state? Do I have well-being in terms of my work life? Am I serving something greater than myself, which we know makes people what we'd call happier? There's a study now called positive psychology. We used to study only the negative, people that were depressed or quote unquote sick. And, smartly, scientists came along and said, well, why don't we study what makes us well and thrive? And that's where this field came along called positive psychology. I have a friend in the film, Dacher Keltner from Berkeley, who has been studying this for years. And all the things that you already intuit make, for a meaningful life, a joy-filled life, are what we're finding in positive psychology. So the number one thing that makes people, quote unquote, whether you use the word happy or content or in the state of well-being, the number one thing is positive relationships. When you have strong positive relationships in your life, whether it's a family or a strong friendship circle or both, you report much stronger happiness levels and outcomes than those who are isolated. That already tells you who we are. When we isolate, that's the worst thing you can do to a person, is put them in solitary confinement. I just went through an illness. I had the flu, and it was a form of solitary confinement because I didn't want to get any of my friends sick, and it was a kind of mini torture, because we are so hardwired to need each other and to be there for each other, that when that is pulled away, we literally start to die, and we start to lose our physical health. So the number one thing is relationships. Then one of the next most important things is to serve a cause greater than yourself. Again, this idea of connection. So you're not just working for yourself, whatever it is you're doing, but you're working for your family, for the well-being of your children, your spouse, your community. Those things, again, bring us a sense of wellness, purpose, meaning, and value that really lifts the human spirit and the human psychology, if you will. So I experienced all those things, if you will, by accident, because I'd done the accumulation thing and that didn't work. And then I started to say, well, I see the inequity around me. I don't want to just talk about a world that's filled with inequity. I want to do something about it. And I am the definition of the inequity in the world. So I want to start to be more equitable. So I would share more of my resources, help causes, get involved in causes. And again, that brought me a sense of purpose, a sense of community, a meaning. When I taught, I've taught for free for about almost going on a decade now at the college level and the high school level. And there's a meaning there. There's an exchange there. I have something to offer students in terms of a perspective and experience, and they offer me as much in terms of their perspectives and their enthusiasm, and they give me such hope. But that, again, lifted me. It lifted me. You know, so it really isn't complicated. I think we all know, but we get carried away by those external symbols. The drone of the television that shows us a certain kind of car, the magazine articles, the media that tells us that the person that has this much wealth, a billionaire, that's who we're going to shine the light on. And because you don't have the light shined on you, you're not successful. Those things are pulling us away from who we are.
And it seems like those values really have increased in our lives, in both the education system, in the media we digest, you know, kind of this sort of gossip or celebrity culture. All of these things have kind of been on the rise for the past several decades. You know, the value of money in our lives and the disparity between, you know, the top 0.001% and the bottom 80%.
I would also, though, say that the appearance may be that, but I think that that there is this groundswell of reaction to that very phenomenon that is, again, pointing out the things that are superficial in life. There's a and the inequity that we see around us. There's a groundswell that hasn't quite coalesced yet. You saw it with the Occupy movement a little bit, although it had, I think, a bit of anger to it, and it was against something as opposed to being as much for something as it needed to be. But there was something there. And you see it now in all these service organizations that are rising up at a rate that has never been seen in history. There's 2 to 3 million that they know of, and even more, they theorize that they haven't seen or counted. But there's millions and millions of people and these service organizations that are meeting that need of inequity, that are starting to rise up and say, I want to live for something different. This millennial generation, which many people call selfish and has a low attention span, there's some incredibly positive things about this generation. They have been the first generation to list as their priority serving. So the number one organization that they want to work for is the one I mentioned my father helped found that my brother runs now, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, which treats kids with cancer for free. They find such meaning in that. That's the number one organization. It's an $800 million organization a year because people are that generous. They want to give to kids who are being healed and to the research. But this generation has identified not just that organization, but the whole idea of serving as their priority. And that we've never seen before. So there is always a counter energy. It's like what Gandhi said. You know, hate can rise up for a time, but think about it. It always loses. Love always overcomes it. Always.
I wonder if this is related to what you were starting to discuss in the book with evolution. And you mentioned how essentially the way that wheat, and I'm going to put it in a different way, but the way that wheat and agriculture domesticated humans. You know, we used to be these nomadic tribesmen, and we wouldn't necessarily get into huge conflict over areas. But once we had to store the goods of our wheat production, suddenly wars would develop, and kingdoms would go to war with each other to protect their turf. And this created this enormous violence in the world that lasted for millennia. But I wonder if evolution is also moving towards unification. So cities turned into states, turned into kingdoms, turned into empires, but now we're globalizing and everything's sort of coming together. And the only way to do that is through some sort of cooperation.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. If you look at the roots of history, the history of poverty. Now, by poverty, that's let's define it as when one person has much more than they need and can meet their needs ad infinitum, and a person within an arm's reach can't, and they don't have enough to feed not only themselves but their family, etc. And where did that start in history? And it started right around the time that you just identified, which is when we discovered agriculture and we were able to store things. So the whole tribe may have gone hungry when we were hunters and gatherers for 165,000 years of our history. The vast majority of our history, we didn't have refrigeration. We didn't have storage capabilities. It hadn't been invented yet. It's only been inside of 10,000 years. And so if there was no food, the whole tribe would go hungry, and not just one person, not just two people. And once we began to store and found the ability and the means and the technologies to amass, then we started to say, well, that's mine, and I work. That's mine. I'm the better hunter. I'm the better gatherer. These are all mine, and you don't get any. And we began to lock up the food, and that's where we divided against each other. You know, the word devil, if you look up diaboline, it means to break apart, really essentially to divide. And we started not seeing us as a family, right? What has every mystic come along and said for as long as we can remember and have recorded history? It's, we're a family. And we now know that scientifically we come from the same two parents genetically in sub-Saharan Africa. And that's what the mystic reminds us. And that's what we forgot when agriculture came along. Now, I essentially think that if you believe in God or whatever the creative intelligence is, that it's of course not all a downside, because we got incredibly creative. That's where technology comes from, medicine comes from, the division of labor comes from. We got very creative and we got very, very colorful, and that's all a good thing. If we can just remember now that we're a family, and I think we are, I think that's why these technologies are rising up that you mentioned. The time is here where we are seeing ourselves as connected. We are literally connected by this web, this interconnecting energy called the internet, and that is pulling us together in vision as one civilization. And I think I feel confident that we're going to get there. We're going to start to see each other as a family, as brothers and sisters. And that doesn't mean there are not going to be differences. There's going to be plenty of differences, because some people have different gifts and stronger gifts in certain areas, and there will be more and there will be less, but there won't be people who can't get an operation. We'll stop commoditizing the human body. We'll stop commoditizing art to the tune of tens of millions of dollars. We'll literally share like a family would. He's the lazy one. Well, we're not going to let him starve tonight, the younger brother who's lazy. We're going to feed him, and we're going to show him that it's a much more beautiful way to live when you participate in society. But we're certainly going to feed him, and if he gets sick, we're going to give him medicine. And we don't behave that way right now.
Let's talk about education, because clearly education as it is right now in our school system is missing a lot of this. I mean, right now education is sort of geared towards the standardized test, then the SAT, then college, then get a good job. And none of that dream is sort of coming true. I mean, student loan debt is now at $1 trillion. More than 50% of the unemployed have college degrees. It's sort of like the dream of education hasn't really come true. And what's missing there?
The true purpose of education is what's missing. Education comes from the Latin word educare, meaning to draw out. So the truest form of education is to draw out the uniqueness, the talent, the light, the intelligence of the individual student. Our education system drills in and is a part of that economy that I just talked about, which divides. Okay, kids, some of you are going to win and some of you are going to lose, meaning some of you are going to get A's and go on to grad schools and get the good jobs, and many of you are going to lose. And that's a violent ideology that has us against each other and not for each other and with each other. It's the antithetical idea to that family that I talked about. So our education has developed. It's simply the soul of the society as it moves forward. And the soul of our society right now is geared toward this idea of winning and beating each other. And to the winner belongs the spoils. Competition is fine. It helps us bring out and cull excellence. But to the winner belongs the spoil is the toxicity that has us fighting each other. You know, when an athlete can make $250 million and then the person sweeping the stadium can't educate their children, there's a problem. And that is rampant in our society.
And there is some degree of competition that's sort of healthy. It's a way to better yourself, or even from the inside out. And like you clearly found your dream and your passion when you were in your fifth year of college and you started to take theater and you got into comedy, and clearly competitively you became the top of your field. Like your movies are the best comedies ever. So clearly that drove you, and you're thankful that it drove you that way.
But it's very different. There's a healthy side to competition that is a part of who we are, certainly hardwired to see who's the fastest runner and then to marvel and to be in awe at that excellence, and maybe who's a good comedy director. But the word competition comes from the Latin word competere. It means to strive with. So Larry Bird and Magic Johnson strive with each other, and they see who's excellent. John McEnroe and Bjorn Borg strive with each other as tennis players, and they pull out the excellence of each other. There's great comics like Jim Carrey pulling out the excellence of myself. But it's this idea to the winner belongs the spoils. So when in the Native American culture, when the guy, the hunter was the fastest horse rider, they didn't give him everything. They didn't say, oh, you get everything, nobody else eats. They went, you're incredibly fast on a horse. What's for supper? So we've added this component, this idea to the winner belongs the spoils, and that is a violent ideology. There's no accidents out there.
It almost reminds me of the whole 4 minute mile psychology. So once the 4 minute mile was broken in world record history, suddenly everybody was running a 4 minute mile. Like everybody kind of like went as a pack and beat this record within a year or two. And it seems like the same thing happens across many fields, like art, science, and so on.
That is the healthy side of competition, where you see something, it sparks something in you that you feel you can dig deeper and be more excellent yourself. That's very healthy.
And I'm going to take an extreme segue and relate this to your concepts of entanglement that you mentioned in both in the book and in the documentary I Am. Do you want to maybe kind of describe what you were talking about there? It was the whole, your interest in quantum physics.
Well, quantum physics is the look at the subatomic world. It's the science of the small. And the idea of entanglement is what Einstein called spooky action at a distance. So if there are two particles that have ever been entangled, meaning that they're rotating around the same nuclei at any point, and then you separate them and up to an infinite distance, that if you affect the rotation of one simultaneously, the rotation of the other is affected, meaning they're entangled. Now, how is that possible? That you've moved them across time, across space. You move them this infinite distance. Picture I use an example in the book, picture a bowling ball in L.A. and a bowling ball in New York, and then you move that bowling ball in L.A., but the one in New York moves at exactly the same time. That's not possible, because there's space, there's distance. That requires time to travel. But at the quantum level, at the level of reality, the ultimate reality is the reality of the small, everything is connected, and it's always connected.
And what's fascinating to me is they still have not figured out how this happens. There's theories. We get into like 18 different dimensions, but no one's really come up with an actual way to explain this.
Well, I can explain it, and whether or not it ever holds up, who knows? But it's not my idea. It's the idea of others. It's space is not empty. There is an energy field that is connecting all things at all times. So it's not empty. You just can't see it. Just like you can't see the cell phone energy in the room. You can't see the radio waves in the room. You can't see the energy between particles. So if you had connected that bowling ball and you put, like, let's say a stiff board, and you pull those bowling balls 20 feet apart, but a stiff board is touching both of them, well, then obviously you push one, the other one's going to get pushed because there's a stiff board in between. That's the energy field that's in between.
I guess it's also related to the fact that we still can't explain, 97% of the universe is made up of both dark matter and dark energy, which we have no clue what those things are other than their names.
Yeah, they're just a dark matter. I haven't studied enough because the 70s may have been too hard on me to really sort of dive into dark matter. But I tell you, there is some intelligence behind all of it, and you can feel it, and it does operate and work through certain principles that we think are getting turned upside down, but really when you look at the principle, it's just getting simpler and simpler and simpler. Einstein felt the more complex a discovery, the more you were away from the truth of it. The simpler the refining of that principle or discovery, then you are really on to something. That's why you wanted to find the unified theory.
They've done tests on this entanglement to describe exactly the effect that you said. They've started particles off at the same spot and split them and sent them going in different directions, and then by observing one, the action on the other would happen faster than the speed of light. And the interesting thing is that experiment is kind of a microcosm of what happened at the beginning of the universe. Of course, the Big Bang, all particles, every particle inside all of us, they were all entangled and all split off at the beginning of time. So
that is
an interesting thing to correspond with your theory that it's all connected in some way.
Yes, that's a brilliant insight. That means that all particles have at one point been entangled, because we are the living remnants of the Big Bang theory. We are stardust. We are those that one infinitesimally small point of energy or light that exploded. It's all in us. And we were all entangled at one point. And so once that entanglement is, it can't be broken. So So again, the mystic sums it up as you're all family. You're family with everything that's alive in the universe, not just on this planet, but everywhere. And that's the scientific way of saying it, is we were entangled at some point. It's a brilliant insight, and it's one we ought to take to heart.
Tom, you made me feel smart right now. I'm pleased with myself. I'm proud.
Well done, sir. Well done.
Now, you've always kind of had this inside you. Like you mentioned, you grew up in a charitable household. You know, your dad was heavily involved in charity and so on. Your family was and still is. You mentioned in your book, after Liar Liar, on I think it was opening weekend, you went to a monastery and literally whittled. to kind of I guess you were trying to almost reverse all the intensity of a movie release with something that would bring you back to childhood.
Yeah, well said again. There's that intelligence coming out.
Every now and then I have a flash of it. People are
well
surprised.
Well said. There's such a whirlwind that happens around movies. It almost feels like an illness. I mean, I've been to award shows where people are screaming at the top of their lungs. I think there's a healthy way to greet a celebrity like Tom Hanks or a Jim Carrey. They're brilliant artists, and to be in awe of their art and their brilliance, I completely understand and respect. But the level of celebrity worship that we have and the screaming that I would experience at these premieres, certainly not for me, but for the stars around me, the Jennifer Anistons, the Jim Carreys, the Robin Williams, etc., it almost feels like an illness. And I remember during Liar Liar just wanting to move away from that and move into something more real. And I had studied this monk named Thomas Merton, who really inspired me and found such a profound beauty in nature and in silence and in contemplation. And I went to his monastery, and it really was childlike. I whittled. I turned over turtles by the creek and looked at their bellies and counted rings and tree stumps and then the world's vision lost its power. You know, the idea that you had to have a certain amount of box office to be successful, that success completely spun on its head. It was successful to be appreciative of the breath that was in my lungs, appreciative of that turtle, the beauty of the flower that was blooming around me.
And yet, it still, though, was 10 years. You're going through this transformation, but it was still 10 years before you said, that's it. I am decreasing the amount of luxury I'm buying. In fact, I'm going to start giving it away. You went through the transformation. It took the massive success and then the concussion. Do you think you could have had this transformation, and this is sort of the elephant in the room, do you think that you could have had this transformation without the extreme rise and then the extreme fall brought on by the concussion?
Well, I remember I had what you'd call an extreme transformation pre-concussion, which was I had changed my behavior in my life. The concussion gave me the wherewithal, the courage, the prerogative to make a film about it and to talk to you about it. But no, I think adversity is a part of the journey. And look, we all don't have to have concussions and near-death experiences. That's why people tell stories, so we can learn from those stories and learn from those experiences. And when their experience touches ours, many of us can begin to make changes and to feel the power of a truth pre-concussion and pre-near-death experience. But sometimes, well, yes, it does take. Crisis is a very important thing that happens in the human experience, and it leads to that word opportunity.
I wonder if it's sort of like cleaning a car, in the sense that if a car gets so dirty and you can't see out the window, that's when you have to clean it. And most people avoid going to a car wash until it gets to that point where they can't see anymore. And I wonder if that's the equivalent. Like, we have this goal. We're on the highway. We have this goal. We've got to get there, and nothing will veer us unless we physically can't see anymore. And that's the value of the crisis. It forces us to do this kind of inner cleansing.
Yeah, I like that analogy. I like the death to life analogy as well. You know, a tree and many flowers, before they can rebirth, have to die, or parts of them have to die. And so a tree goes through a sort of death when its leaves are gone, are lost, and it and winter, it hibernates, so to speak, for winter, and then it, boom, it comes back. We, as human beings, often need to get our trees shaken, right? We don't willingly let go of our old dead skin. Oftentimes, we have to get a slap in the face, is what Oprah calls. First, you get, the universe comes and, you know, knocks, you know, like little gentle knocks, and then if you don't listen, it'll rap you right in the head, which is what it did for me.
Well, I like how, and the, you know, this is from, I'm going to quote God in Evan Almighty, but I like how Morgan Freeman says towards the end of the movie, let me ask you something. If someone prays for patience, you think God gives them patience, or does he give them the opportunity to be patient? If he prayed for courage, does God give him courage, or does he give him opportunities to be courageous? And I think our world today, you know, you mentioned that in the beginning of the documentary, I Am, you were trying to answer the question, what is wrong with the world? And it's almost like what is wrong with the world are all of these many opportunities to be courageous, to, you know, to put it in God's words.
Yeah. Yes. And so therefore, is it really wrong? It's actually what's right with the world, because without those opportunities, without the person who's in need of an education, I don't get activated. But I, because I'm a teacher at my heart, their need, it creates activation and life, and a story starts to happen. So I wouldn't say I don't approach it anymore by what's wrong with the world. I see exactly what's right with it. And the world knows exactly what it needs, so it presents itself to us. It presents itself to us in sometimes very violent ways because it needs more love, right? We need to be more compassionate to each other. We need to reinvent education. That's why so much violence is right in the midst of education. We don't see it that way. We think there's a mental illness outside of us that's taking place by that one student at that one school when we're all participating in that mental illness. And so life's going to keep throwing these opportunities, as you said, to be patient, opportunity to be compassionate, to rethink the way we're doing things, the way we're relating to each other. And I think that's beautiful. As much pain,
I like how
as
you
that
describe
causes.
Mental illness in I Am as the, you know, sort of this idea that you take much more than you need, and that's a form of mental illness. And then you kind of compare that to, on the cellular level, to cancer, which are basically cells that are essentially, you know, actively trying to consume more than they need.
Right, taking everything and not realizing that they're destroying the body that is supporting their life. And that's why the poet has said, I don't know if there's ever been a wise, mega rich person, because who could hoard all these resources, and those resources could nourish 1,000 lives.
But let's take a look at that. Like, clearly, again, you don't want to, like, some people have made a lot of money and are rich, and they're not going to give it away, or they're going to give it away in their own, you know, ways. It's not like you're judging this, because we all have, and to some extent, everybody in the United States has wealth compared to somebody in, I don't know, Zimbabwe or wherever.
There's a difference between judging a person who's on a path. If someone came along and judged me while I was, you know, had, you know, millions accumulating, etc., I would have said, hey, dude, shut up. Like, I'm working hard and I'm doing the best I can and I'm doing what I can to share. Now, I've woken up to a different place and I was allowed to go on my journey and I didn't have someone pointing the finger at me. And I don't point the finger at anyone wealthy, because like you said, there's various layers of wealth, and what we may consider even an impoverished person in this country could be incredibly wealthy across the world. But what I do want to look at and assess is the value that is creating all this wealth, the value with which our society is moving forward, the values with which we're teaching our kids, and then what are the outcomes when so much wealth gets held up, right? When it gets held up. So, yeah, it's in a stock over here, or it's in a bank, or it's in a bond over there, but there's a person right there. There's a river that's dying. And all that, it's all energy. And I do want to look at that. Again, without judgment, a fair and honest assessment of how can we work together in a healthier way. And I don't think there's a rich person alive that doesn't want to look and see how they can contribute to healing the world. That's what wealthy people are, beautiful people. They're incredibly creative, smart, intelligent, just good folks, and they want the world to heal as well. So I want to have that conversation. because there is a tremendous... We have the cure for hunger, my friend. We have it. We don't need it. And 17,000 kids will die today. We have the cure. We have the cure. So it's a matter of looking at this as a society and saying, why isn't it activated?
Well, why isn't it?
Because we're not seeing things as they are. We're not seeing those kids as our kids. We're not seeing, there's not a person, not one of those wealthy people that I described, or even someone of modest wealth, that would let somebody starve in front of them. It's this distance, this feeling of disconnect. And we're participating in a philosophy that is creating this hunger. We're participating in this get what you can philosophy, which always has a consequence. If you read Emerson's essay, Compensation, for every plus, there is a minus, right? A rising tide does not raise all boats. That's a fallacy. Across the world, the boats are lowered, right? The rising tide here means a lower tide over there. And we're not seeing this compensation and our effect of intense accumulation. Just storage. If Americans got out of storage alone, storage, we could end, I believe it's 2/3 or 3/4 of world hunger. So just saving grandma's couch, and again, I'm as guilty as anyone, so this is not a finger point. I hope this is an assessment and a conversation, but saving grandma's couch, we could heal the world in terms of global hunger.
I love how it gets back to storage, and you know, again, this thing that suddenly happened to us as a species in 10,000 BC, which is that out of nowhere we started growing wheat, so we didn't have to like travel around so much, and we started storing it, and everything bad kind of happened after that. Like our diet was ruined, our sense of kind of community with our tribesmen was ruined. Our focus on specialization as opposed to generalization started, which continues to this day in our educational system. You know, all of these things that maybe globalization and, as you say, compassion and relationships and so on, and service will hopefully solve.
Yeah, we've got to see it, though, and we don't see it. It's
you know,
very
and
easy.
And it's funny, too. Again, I'm going to quote Evan Almighty, which I think is a great movie. But the acts of random kindness that,
right.
You know, the character God talks about in the movie. If everybody basically, if all they did was that and focus on doing that during the day, I think there would be a huge difference in society.
Yes, yes, and it's the personal revolution being the true revolution. You know, Evan went to change the world. That's sort of the thrust of the movie, and he was going to go to Congress and change the law. And what the journey showed him was that the change starts with me, with each act, with each thought, with each way that I move forward in the world, all the energy that I put out. It starts right here, and it doesn't have to be big.
And, you know, it's funny, the initial reaction when somebody does that, or like the initial reaction to Evan in that movie, is first one of selfishness. Like, why are you just thinking about your own needs? Until, you know, but really, though, and I believe it was Gandhi who said this, you change the world by each person changing themselves. And I think too many people are think in terms of like the Occupy Wall Street, like we have to, invade Wall Street or whatever and go to war, which is, again, this angry negative thing, as opposed to each person focusing on how they could be better and healthier on the inside.
Yeah, I think the wars, the external wars are sort of the accumulation of all the energy, the violent energy that we put out from a moment to moment. And wars start with us. They start with us wanting to protect us and our things and me, me, me. And then it globalizes, it scales up, and it becomes a one nation against another nation.
So the
power we give away because we think that the problems are outside of us is enormous. And people are beginning to wake up en masse to this idea that if you want to change the world, you change yourself. You start with yourself, and then you can't not become involved in larger issues. You can't not want to start to work for your township, for your community, to create a better education system, etc.
And so what if someone is just completely clueless, like they have never experienced otherwise, like they grew up in a goal-driven family, they went through the educational system, they rose up in their companies. how do they kind of switch mindsets? And let's say, assume they are interested in switching mindsets, but they just don't know how. What's kind of the first step? And again, you say, you say you're not going to give the 10 steps in life's operating manual, but you have given some steps here in this interview. Like, what would you say is the first step?
Do the opposite. That's what I would say. So if
it's
you've lived a life
though,
only for yourself.
We don't know what the opposite is.
Well, we have to define who this person is, but to give them a step. But let's say you've lived only for yourself. Let's have a thought about how is my behavior, this business decision, affecting, let's say, my family? And then let me go even larger. How's it affecting my community? And if everyone, if it's not a win-win for everyone, you stop doing it. You stop doing it. Let's say you have, again, a large footprint in terms of your, let's say, your gas or your carbon footprint. You say, you know what, I'm going to do something really small. I'm going to buy a bike, and I'm going to ride a bike one day a week to work just to see how that is. Sounds like a super small thing to do, but imagine in L.A., for example, where we have a real challenge in terms of traffic and the energy that locks the city up. Imagine if every fifth person did that. Suddenly things would move, and it'd be a city that worked better. That small act changed my life. I started commuting to work on a bicycle. I woke up to the joy and that playfulness again. I just started riding a bike. And I didn't do it for exercise. I did it because it was fun.
The playfulness is an interesting thing. And I had this discussion last week with Arianna Huffington, who was on the podcast. We talked about the statistic that children laugh on average 300 times a day.
Yeah.
But adults laugh on average only 5 times a day.
Yes.
Somehow between childhood and adulthood, we've like completely lost the ability to laugh. And laughter is so important to both outer and inner health. Like, I mean, it releases endorphins, it releases oxytocin. All these neurochemicals that are good for you come from what's called inner jogging, which is laughter. And somehow we've forgotten that playfulness.
Yeah, which is, again, why the mystic, why the moral leaders, Jesus even said, unless you become like these little children, you are not going to enter the kingdom of heaven. And that child knows something that we've forgotten. And it's all around the same idea, control, control, control. The child has very little control over their life, right? They're dependent in so many different ways. And we try to control everything. This is why children laugh. You know, I've done some base humor in my films. I've done, you know, the fart joke.
Which is always funny, by the way. Automatically funny.
It is if you have retained your childlikeness. But oftentimes, because we're trying to control, and what are the two periods of our life that we can't control? When we're infants, and then we have to go in diapers, and then when we're older. When we're old, we oftentimes lose control, we have to go in diapers. And so in between, we try to control, and so anything that reminds us of that time we're out of control, that childlikeness, we rail against, and we lose that joy. We lose that joy of just, that's funny, that's beautiful, and we stop smiling. It's all about getting serious, and I love this quote from Thomas Merton: what is serious to men is often very trivial in the eyes of God, but what in God might appear to us as play is perhaps what he himself takes most seriously. And I think we've forgotten the seriousness of the celebration, of the dance, of the joy, of the experience of being alive. We've forgotten that to become someone, you know, to achieve something. And there's no greater achievement than that smile you talked about that the kid experiences 300 times a day.
It does bring to mind, though, that it's not just control, but also responsibility. So you mentioned young people and you mentioned old people. These are the two groups of society that have essentially the least responsibility for family, children, their own livelihoods. But it's at the age of 40, it turns out, that people are least happy, you know, in various studies of positive psychology and stuff. At the age of 40, that's the critical moment when someone has the hardest time being happy, probably because of responsibilities as well. So there's this hunger to make money so that they feel like they can play again once they make the money to take care of their families.
I don't think it's responsibility that makes us unhappy. I think responsibility can be a very motivating positive thing in our lives. It's the fact that we believe we're in it by ourselves and we're on our own and that we have no help and that if I don't do it, it's not going to happen, and you take that burden on. That's why, you know, the tribal culture is new, and we have that saying that's rolled over to today. It takes a village to raise a family. It takes a village. We've forgotten that. Now it's up to mom, or it's up to dad, or it's up to mom and dad, and just them and only them, and they're not going to get any help from anybody. We're not in this together. All those things create, they're exactly who you're not. And just the fact you have a family shows you who you are, which is, I want to relate. That kind of burden is what we add to responsibility. And what we add, this isolation idea, that creates very, very unhappy people.
Yes. So, Tom, the Life's Operating Manual is coming out in paperback in a week or so. You had the movie, the documentary, I Am. How else are you going to kind of, what's the next step? How else are you going to continue this message to people that's very important?
Well, it's my life. You know, I want to be the message, as Gandhi said. I want my life to be the message. But practically, I continue to teach. But I'm more than likely, I was just offered a radio show with Sirius. Sirius Radio. I did a 6-week program for them. We all had a great time. They enjoyed it. We enjoyed it. And I'll be doing a show on Monday through Friday, probably on Sirius XM Indy 104. I think it's going to be 3 p.m. here in LA, 6:00 East Coast time. And we're going to talk about this kind of stuff. We'll refine it a little bit in terms of maybe we'll just talk about education one show. We'll talk about maybe films in one show, art in one show, et cetera. But always
that's a lot of work every single day.
Well, yeah, I think I'm going to enjoy it. I enjoy this conversation. I enjoy engaging with people. I enjoy dialogue. And if I don't enjoy it, I won't continue to do it. So. It is a lot. It's, you know, it's a good 300 hours a year. But, you know, I think Oprah found when she did her show for 25 years that the human library, that resource is inexhaustible. There's so many powerful stories. Some can be cautionary tales. Some can be inspiring. But we certainly need, as a nation and larger culture, the world needs to have a conversation about what we can do different. And it's not about pointing fingers at each other like we see on television. Oh, those Republicans are so dumb. Those Democrats are so naive. It's not about that. It's about the principles on which we can move forward as a society. And then if we see things differently, the machinations, it's not going to be near as divisive as it is now. We've got to agree on the principle.
And what about in terms of movie making? Is that chapter closed for you at the moment?
It may be. I dabbled back in for a little while, but for whatever reasons, the doors didn't stay open. I can't tell you why. I've been investing in documentaries and involved in that world, but narrative-wise, doesn't seem to be my path right now.
So, Tom, thank you so much for coming on the show. Life's Operating Manual, I highly recommend it. But not only that, I feel it's a companion piece to your documentary, I Am, which I really encourage people see. And your book's coming out in paperback, so I encourage people to get it. And then I look forward to what's next. I'm going to drive around in my car just so I can listen to you on Sirius when your show starts.
I would be honored, brother. Call in sometime. We'll engage in more dialogue. The show is called One Big Couch.
Okay, excellent. I like that name. And thanks once again, and enjoy.
All right, brother. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. Take care.
Thank you.
Peace. Bye-bye.
Bye, Tom.
Wow, what a great interview. So, James, what's your big takeaway from what Tom had to say?
You know, Aaron, it's very interesting because, obviously, incredibly inspirational. It takes enormous guts to walk away from everything I shouldn't even put it that way because I feel like Tom would say he walked away from nothing and got everything. I think to the core, he's inspirational. And I think, you know, truly walks the walk and talks the talk. And as many of our listeners know, you know, I've been through almost kind of at gunpoint, a similar experience. I've made a lot of money. I've lost a lot of money. I've been broke and had to kind of rise up from the ashes and came to many similar conclusions. Even as I made back the money, I, you know, was forced to keep my own discipline and focus on what was really important, which is, you know, again, health from the inside, physical, emotional, mental, and yes, spiritual health. That health, that focus on inner health brings inner wealth, and that inner wealth spreads out to all the people around you. And I think personally, that's the best way to live your life. And it certainly seems like Tom has found the best way for him to live his life. And it's really impressive to see. Again, I encourage everybody to go out and buy Life's Operating Manual, or heck, steal it if you want. I don't know. But read it. And, you know, once again, this has been a great show. So send me any questions at james@stansberryradio.com. The reason I'm asking for questions is we're about to launch another podcast, a daily podcast separate from this one. It's going to be Ask Altucher, where I will answer a different question each episode. And it could be about anything. Be about stocks. It could be about startups. It could be about your marriage, your relationships, your kids, everything you're afraid of, your anxieties, hate, fear, stress, whatever you want, ask me and I'll do my best to answer. I don't know if the answers will be correct or helpful at all, but at least it'll be entertaining for me. And once again, thanks for joining us on the show.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network at stansberryradio.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.